She was not merely rejected. She was humiliated before 500 of England's most powerful witnesses by the very Duke she had given 7 years of her life to, on what was supposed to be their wedding day. Broken and alone, she walked away from the altar with nothing but her dignity. But dignity, it turns out, is exactly the kind of thing that draws a certain kind of man. And when she returned to society, standing at the side of someone entirely unexpected, the Duke, who had discarded her, felt something he had not anticipated. Regret has a particular look on a man who has never worn it before. Camille Kensington never imagined that the greatest love of her life would begin in the ruins of the worst day she had ever lived. The morning of October the 14th, 1852, arrived like a painting no artist had dared to finish. Fog rolled across the grounds of Thornwick Hall in slow, heavy waves, curling around the stone columns and swallowing the lower hedgerows whole. The oak trees along the long gravel drive stood dark and leafless against a sky that had not yet decided whether to offer light or withhold it. Somewhere beyond the mist, the bells of St. Bartholomew Chapel had already begun their low, resonant tolling, the sound deep enough to feel in the chest, steady enough to count breaths by. Inside Thornwick Hall, no one was still. Servants moved through every corridor with the controlled urgency of people who understood the weight of the day. Footmen carried towering arrangements of white roses and French lilies, their arms trembling with the effort. Maids pressed wrinkles from silk table runners with irons that released small clouds of steam. A jeweler had arrived at dawn to verify the condition of 3 pieces of Kensington heirloom jewellery. 2 tailors waited in the antechamber with their needles threaded, ready for any final adjustment required. 500 invitations had gone out. 500 of England's most powerful, most titled, most watchful individuals were expected to fill the pews of St. Bartholomew by noon. The Morning Post had already named it, in bold black letters above the society column, the wedding of the decade. And at the very center of all of it, at the quiet, still, breathless center, stood Camille Kensington. She was 24 years old, and she was not trembling. That was the first thing one noticed about Camille. Not her beauty, though that was present. The clean line of her jaw, the dark sweep of her lashes, the slender neck that her mother had always called her best feature. What one noticed first was her stillness, the quality of her composure, the way she stood before the long, gilded mirror in her chamber, as though she were something carved rather than something living, held in perfect control by a discipline she had spent 7 years perfecting. Her bridal gown was ivory silk, its bodice fitted with a precision that spoke of months of work. The skirts fell in layers, each one a shade warmer than the last, so that the whole effect shimmered faintly when she moved, like cream catching a candle's edge. Her dark hair had been swept and pinned by her lady's maid with architecture that rivaled any structure in London. Small pearls were threaded through it. Her gloves were already on. White silk to the elbow, smooth and unblemished. She looked, by every measurable standard, like exactly what this day required. Her mother, Lady Clara Kensington, stood behind her, reflected in the glass. Clara was a woman of 50, who had never entirely forgiven time for what it had done to her cheekbones, but she dressed magnificently and held herself with the iron posture of someone who had always understood that appearance was its own form of power. "You look precisely as a duchess should look," her mother said. "Hold your chin a fraction higher." "Not too much." "That much," Camille adjusted. Not because she disagreed. Not because she agreed. Simply because adjusting cost nothing, and disagreeing would cost the next 20 minutes. Her attention was not on her mother. Her attention was on her wrist, specifically on the bracelet that encircled it, a slim chain of gold, set with 5 sapphires, each stone the exact blue of a late summer sky. Alexander had sent it from Vienna 4 years into his absence, wrapped in brown paper and accompanied by a letter written in his confident, slightly sprawling hand. These are the colour of the sky over the Alps when the light falls correctly at evening. I find myself thinking, when I see it, that the sky has not been the same colour since I left England. I am enclosing this so that you will know, wherever I am, the colour of the sky reminds me of you. She could still recall the precise sensation of opening that package, the way her fingers had worked at the string, the way the bracelet had caught the morning light from her bedroom window and scattered small blue points across the ceiling. She had worn it every day since. 7 years. 7 years of letters. 7 years of waiting. 7 years of turning away every man who had attempted to approach her family with a proposal, because she had been promised, not publicly. The formal announcement had been reserved for Alexander's return, but the promise existed, and it was as real to Camille as any document her father had signed. Their fathers had agreed upon it. The Kensington estate and the Ravenshire fortune had been quietly aligned in anticipation of it. Society knew without being told, the way society always knew things without being told. Camille Kensington was spoken for, and Alexander Stirling, 7th Duke of Ravenshire, was coming home to claim her. She thought now of the last time she had seen him. October, 1845. She had been 17, and he had been 22, and they had stood beneath the oak tree at the far end of the East Garden, while his carriage waited on the drive. He had been tall even then, with the particular kind of handsomeness that came from good bone structure rather than effort. Dark eyes, a straight nose, a way of standing that suggested he was accustomed to rooms turning toward him. He had taken her hand. He had held it, properly, formally, in his gloved one. And he had said, "I will return, Camille. You have my word." That was all. No declaration of love, no poetic speech. He was 22 and pressed for time, and not, she had understood even then, a man who arranged his feelings into sentences easily. But his eyes had held hers long enough that she had believed him. The sincerity in them had been unmistakable. The intention had been real. She had believed him for 7 years. He had returned 8 months ago, 30 years old now, broader in the shoulder, darker in the eye, carrying about him the particular gravity of a man who has spent years in rooms where the wrong word could start a war. Society had welcomed him back with embarrassing enthusiasm. Every hostess in London had wanted him at her table. Every newspaper had printed his portrait. He was celebrated, admired, powerful in ways that exceeded even what his title already granted him. He had called on the Kensington house within a fortnight of his return. He had been courteous, measured, perfectly appropriate. He had not been warm. Camille had told herself it was the adjustment. He had been abroad for 7 years. He was relearning England. He was tired. Men returned from long service, carrying things they were not yet ready to set down. She had told herself all of this, patiently and thoroughly, the way she told herself most things that required patience and thoroughness. 6 months of courtship, formal, correct, observed by society, had passed, and now here she was, on the morning of October the 14th, in ivory silk with sapphires on her wrist, ready to become his duchess. The door to her chamber opened. Mabel came in. Camille watched her sister's reflection enter the glass. Mabel Kensington was 20 years old, and the world had always found her easier to look at than Camille. Brighter, softer, the kind of beauty that asks nothing difficult of the observer. Her hair was lighter. Her laugh was quicker. She had none of Camille's discipline, and none of her depth, and these absences read, to most of society, as virtues. People called Mabel charming. People called Camille admirable, which was the word they used when they did not know what else to say. Mabel was dressed for the wedding in pale cornflower blue. The color should have been understated. Instead, on Mabel, it glowed. "You look beautiful," Mabel said. Her voice was soft, perfectly calibrated. Camille turned from the mirror to look at her directly, and in that moment, in the space between one breath and the next, she noticed something that she could not immediately name. Something in the brightness of Mabel's eyes. Something in the particular quality of her smile. It was not happiness exactly, or rather it was happiness that had been present longer than this morning. It was the happiness of someone who had been holding a secret with both hands and was now very close to setting it down. "Thank you," Camille said. Mabel crossed the room and adjusted one of Camille's pearl pins with a light, sisterly touch. Her fingers were steady, completely steady. Why are her hands so steady? Camille's mind moved quietly over the question. She is always nervous in large gatherings. She cried at Margaret Ashford's wedding from pure excitement. Why are her hands so steady today? She filed it away. There was no time, and the observation was small, and surely it was nothing. Her mother called for them both. The carriages were ready. St. Bartholomew Chapel was full to its last pew. The building was old, 14th-century stone, grey and immovable, its windows fitted with deep coloured glass that painted the interior in shifting jewel tones when the sun moved. Today the sun was cautious, offering itself in thin lines through the fog, but enough light reached the interior to set the gold fixtures gleaming and to make the 24 candelabras along the aisle burn cleanly without competition. Camille sat in the antechamber and listened to the organ. The music was dignified and correct and utterly impersonal, the way all chapel music was, and she had nothing to do with her hands except hold her bouquet, white roses and trailing ivy, and breathe. She heard the murmur of 500 voices settling. She heard the precise moment when Alexander entered from the side door and took his place at the altar, because the murmur dropped, briefly, into near silence, then rose again with a different texture. The text of appreciation for a man whom society considered its greatest eligible prize, now finally, publicly, officially taking his place. Her father came to stand beside her. Lord William Kensington was 61 years old and had the permanently strained expression of a man who had spent 4 decades managing a family estate that had always cost slightly more than it produced. This marriage, this alliance, was the resolution of a problem he had been carrying for 15 years. He did not look at Camille's face. He looked at the chapel door. "Head up," he said. "Walk steadily. Do not look at the guests." "Yes, father." The door opened. 500 pairs of eyes turned. Camille walked. She had imagined this moment so many times over 7 years that she expected, when it arrived, to feel the weight of all those imagined versions pressing down on the real one. Instead, she felt something quieter. Something almost like clarity. The aisle was long, and the candles burned, and the roses in her arms were cold from the morning chill, and her dress made a soft sound against the stone floor with each step. She kept her eyes on the altar. She kept them on Alexander. He was, in the morning light filtering through the chapel's coloured glass, everything he had always been and more. The years had added something, not age exactly, but consequence. He stood straight and composed in his dark coat, his hands clasped at his back. And as she walked toward him, Camille thought, with a feeling so familiar it barely registered, "This is the man I have been waiting for." She was 20 feet away when she noticed it. He was not meeting her eyes. He was looking at her, at the general direction of her, but not at her eyes. His gaze kept shifting, just slightly, just fractionally, in the way that a person's gaze shifts when they cannot bear to land directly on what they are looking at. 10 feet. His jaw was set. She had seen that particular set of his jaw once before, during a difficult conversation about estate finances, when he had been resolving himself to say something unpleasant. 5 feet. Her steps slowed of their own accord. Not from hesitation. She was not a woman who hesitated, but from some animal intelligence that lived below thought, below decision, in the place where the body knows things the mind has not yet admitted. She reached the altar. The bishop opened his book. Alexander raised his hand. The sound of that raised hand, the small movement of air it displaced, the slight rustle of his sleeve, should have been nothing. Should have gone unnoticed in a room of 500 people. But it had the effect of a stone dropped into still water. Every person present felt the ripple before they understood its source. Bishop paused. Alexander said, "I cannot marry Camille." The silence that followed those 5 words was the loudest thing Camille had ever heard in her life. It was not a silence of shock, exactly. Shock was too immediate, too clean. This was the silence of 500 people simultaneously losing the language for what they were witnessing and finding. In that loss, no other sound to fill the space. Camille did not move. She did not look away from Alexander's face, because she had not yet been given permission, by herself, by her body, by any of the mechanisms she relied on, to react. She simply stood with her bouquet in her arms and her sapphire bracelet on her wrist and waited for the next sentence. Because there had to be a next sentence. Because what he had just said was not a complete thought. He said, "I have tried to honor the arrangement our families made. I have tried to behave as duty required. But there is a woman in this room whom I love, and I cannot stand before God and marry another while she is present." The murmur that ran through the congregation was low and collective and horrified. And then, from the front pew, Camille heard the faint sound of silk. She turned. Mabel was rising. Mabel, in her cornflower blue gown, was rising from her seat in the Kensington family pew. Not stumbling. Not hesitating. Rising with the careful grace of someone who knew exactly what she was about to do, and had known it for a very long time. Mabel was not shocked. Camille's mind travelled with terrible, quiet efficiency back to the morning. To Mabel's steady hands, to the particular quality of her smile, to the brightness in her eyes that had been present before the ceremony began. She knew. The understanding arrived not as a blow, but as a tide. Slow, cold, thorough. This was not an accident. This was not Alexander swept away by feeling at the final moment. This had been planned. The pale blue gown had not been chosen for a guest. Mabel had come to this chapel already knowing she would leave it differently than she had entered. Camille's mother made a sound that was not quite a word. Her father stood very still. Alexander extended his hand toward Mabel. She took it. There are moments in a person's life that become dividing lines. Before and after, the self that existed prior to the moment and the self that must be built in the aftermath. Most people recognize these moments only in retrospect, once enough time has passed to make the line visible from a distance. Camille recognized it while it was happening. Standing at the altar of St. Bartholomew Chapel, on the 14th of October, 1852, with 500 witnesses arranged around her, and the man she had waited 7 years for holding her sister's hand, she felt the dividing line pass through her like a blade drawn slowly enough to feel every inch of it. She did not cry. She decided, very specifically, not to. Not because the grief was not there. It was there. Enormous. Dark. Rising. But it was hers, and she would not give this room the satisfaction of seeing it. She would not give Alexander the comfort of it. She would not give Mabel the victory of it. Lord William stepped forward, his face mottled with rage and humiliation, and spoke in a low, furious voice to Alexander about honor and agreement and financial arrangements. Alexander responded calmly about matters of the heart, superseding financial considerations. Their father's voices overlapped and rose, and society watched in the absorbed, riveted way that people watch things they will discuss for decades. Camille was not listening. She was looking at the bracelet on her wrist. She reached up with her right hand, her gloved fingers steady. Completely steady, she would not let them shake, and unclasped it. The gold was warm from her skin. The sapphires caught the chapel light for one final moment, scattering blue points across her glove. She held it in her closed fist. She walked to Alexander. He turned to face her, and she saw it then. The guilt. It was real. He had not expected this to be painless. He had not expected her not to cry either, and her composure seemed to trouble him more than tears would have. She held out her hand, opened it. The bracelet lay across her palm. "I believe this belongs to no one now," she said. She kept her voice at a register that only Alexander could hear. She would not perform this moment. It was not for the chapel. It was only for him. He took it. His fingers brushed her glove. She turned to Mabel. "May you enjoy everything you were so eager to take," she said. Then she turned and walked the full length of the aisle, alone, in ivory silk, with 500 pairs of eyes following every step. The chapel was silent, except for her footfalls on the stone. She did not look to the left or the right. She did not pause. She reached the doors, and a footman, blinking in confusion, pushed them open for her, and she walked out into the cold October fog and breathed. The carriage was still at the gate, her own carriage, the Kensington one, intended to carry her away after the wedding as the Duchess of Ravenshire. She reached it. The driver looked down at her in her bridal gown with an expression of complete bewilderment. She climbed in without assistance. She settled herself against the seat. She straightened her spine. She placed her hands, still gloved, still steady, in her lap. "Belgrave House," she said. "In Mayfair?" The carriage moved. And then, with no one to see her, Camille Kensington pressed her face into her hands and allowed herself, for the full duration of the drive, to feel everything she had refused to feel in the chapel. The grief that came was not quiet. It did not stay in her chest. It moved through her entirely, shaking her shoulders and stealing her breath and making sounds she had never made before, raw, animal sounds that she didn't recognize as coming from herself until they were already in the air. She had waited 7 years. She had given everything. She had believed him. By the time the carriage turned into Mayfair, she had controlled herself again. Her eyes were red. Her breathing was uneven, but her spine was straight and her hands had returned to her lap. She had cried. That was done. It was the last time she intended to cry for Alexander Stirling. She kept that promise to herself more faithfully than he had ever kept any promise to her. Belgrave House was tall and narrow and slightly apart from its neighbours on the Mayfair Street, as though it had, over the years, edged away from proximity to anyone it found tedious. Its stone façade was dark with age. Its iron gate was old enough that the hinges required the particular knowledge of how to lift and turn simultaneously, a detail that Lady Cordelia Wallace had never bothered to have repaired, because she preferred that casual visitors experience minor frustration before gaining entry. Cordelia Wallace was 63 years old and had been a widow for 22 of them. And she had used those 22 years with an efficiency that would have impressed any general. She had invested her late husband's fortune intelligently, cultivated friendships that were genuinely useful, severed acquaintances that were not, travelled extensively without apology, and developed opinions on everything from parliamentary reform to the proper temperature at which Bordeaux should be served, which she shared freely with anyone and refused to moderate for anyone. Society was slightly afraid of her. She preferred it that way. When the Kensington carriage pulled up to Belgrave House on the morning of October the 14th, Lady Cordelia was in her private sitting room, reading correspondence and drinking coffee that was stronger than any doctor would have sanctioned. Her butler appeared in the doorway with an expression that had abandoned its usual composure. "Miss Kensington has arrived, my lady. In." He paused with professional dignity. "Her bridal gown." Cordelia set down her coffee. "Show her in," she said. "Tell cook to prepare tea. Something warm and something strong, and then leave us entirely alone." Camille was brought in a moment later, and Cordelia looked at her niece, at the ivory silk and the careful posture and the red-rimmed eyes that Camille was clearly refusing to acknowledge, and felt something move in her chest that she would have been reluctant to name in polite company, because it had no polite name. It was fury, and it was grief, and it was a fierce, protective love that was several decades older than this morning. She rose from her chair. She did not ask questions. She simply crossed the room, took Camille by the shoulders, looked at her for one long moment, taking in the whole of it, the gown and the composure and the damage beneath the composure, and then held her. Camille allowed it. Only briefly. Only long enough to accept the fact of someone being on her side. Then she stepped back, gathered herself, and sat. "Tell me," Cordelia said. Camille told her. Cleanly. Efficiently. Without embellishment. She had a gift for that, for the precise rendering of facts in order, without the emotional decoration that would have slowed the telling and required of her more than she currently had to give. When she finished, Cordelia was quiet for a moment. "The gown," she said finally. "What?" "Give it to me. We will put it somewhere. It will not have the opportunity to grieve at you every time you open a wardrobe." Camille looked down at herself. She had forgotten, in the interval, that she was still wearing it. "I don't care what you do with it." "Good. I'll have it packed. We will discuss it never again." Cordelia poured tea and set a cup before Camille with the definitive click of someone making a decision. "Now, society." "We'll be delighted," Camille said. "Society will be temporarily delighted and permanently confused," Cordelia corrected, "which is the state in which society is most manageable. They will write letters of pity. You will not respond to them. They will whisper that you are ruined. You will appear in public within 3 weeks, looking so thoroughly unruined that the whispers will have to find something else to sustain them. I am not certain I am capable of that at present. You are 24, educated, possessed of an independent income from your grandmother's settlement, and you have just demonstrated, before 500 witnesses, more dignity than any other woman in that chapel. You are thoroughly capable of it." Cordelia leaned back. "You simply need time and somewhere to be while you collect yourself. Belgrave House is that somewhere." The letters began arriving the following morning. They came in quantities that required the butler to organize them by category, those from genuine sympathy, those from people who wanted information, those from society hostesses managing their invitation lists, and one from Lord William Kensington, Camille's father, which she recognized by his seal and left unopened on the hall table for 4 days. When she finally opened it, it said what she expected. He blamed her. Not in those exact words. Lord William was always careful with exact words. But the implication ran through every sentence like a current. If she had been more engaging, more warm, more like Mabel, this would not have happened. He mentioned the financial arrangements that had now dissolved. He mentioned his own embarrassment. He mentioned, briefly, that he hoped she would return home when she was feeling more herself. She folded the letter and placed it in the fire and watched it burn. She was not going home. It was on the 4th day of her residence at Belgrave House that Camille found the letters. She had retreated, as she would retreat many times in the weeks that followed, into Cordelia's library. A long room at the back of the house that smelled of old paper and beeswax, and the faint ghost of Cordelia's late husband's tobacco. The shelves ran from floor to ceiling, and required a rolling ladder to access the upper reaches, and Camille found in this room what she had always found in libraries, the particular comfort of being among people, in a sense, without being required to perform for them. She was replacing a volume of Keats in its gap, on the second shelf, when she noticed the letters. They were tucked behind a row of books, not hidden with any sophistication, more set aside than concealed, the way someone sets something aside when they expect to retrieve it soon, and do not anticipate anyone else reaching behind that particular row. There were seven of them, each folded and sealed with plain wax, each bearing Mabel's handwriting on the outer fold, not addressed, but clearly sorted by date. Camille stood with one in her hand for a long moment. She was aware that what she was about to do carried its own kind of pain. She was also aware that she was past the point where the promise of pain was a sufficient reason to avoid the truth. She opened the first letter. It was dated 14 months earlier. "Dearest A," it began, "I received your letter this morning, and I confess I have read it 3 times already. I should not be writing to you. Camille does not know that we have corresponded these past months, and I find myself unable to decide whether the secrecy makes everything easier or harder. I think of you constantly. I think of whether what I feel is real or simply the excitement of something forbidden. But then your words arrive, and I think, this is real. This cannot be anything but real." Camille sat down on the library floor. She sat there for a very long time, surrounded by Mabel's letters, all 7 of them, spanning 14 months, and read them in order. They told, in Mabel's unguarded, unpracticed hand, the complete story of what had grown between her sister and Alexander, while Camille had been making bridal plans and attending dress fittings. The correspondence had begun, apparently, when Alexander first returned and called on the Kensington house. He had written to Mabel separately. She had written back. What had started, perhaps, as something neither of them had named, had accumulated, over those months, into something that could not be set aside. It was, Camille noted, with the distant, analytical part of her mind, that was still functioning. A genuine love story. She could see it in the letters. The real feeling was there, raw and accumulating, and specific. It was not manipulation on Mabel's part. It was not calculation on Alexander's. It was simply a love story that had happened in the wrong place, at the wrong time, at someone else's expense. That did not make it forgivable, but it made it comprehensible in a way that was, somehow, almost worse. Malice could be dismissed and hated and gotten past. This accidental, costly, real feeling was harder. There was no satisfying villain. There was only wreckage, and people who had caused it while not quite intending to cause it. And Camille sitting on a library floor in Mayfair, reading letters that had been hidden behind the Keats. She replaced the letters exactly as she had found them. She climbed the stairs to her room. She sat by the window and looked at the street below until Cordelia knocked and entered and sat beside her, without requiring an explanation. "Tell me about Malcolm Faulkner," Camille said eventually. Cordelia was quiet for a moment. "What made you think of him?" "You mentioned him earlier, in passing. You said society feared him." "Society does many things," Cordelia said. "It fears what it cannot categorize. Malcolm Faulkner does not permit himself to be categorized." She considered. "He is 36, Duke of Ashbourne. The estate is in Derbyshire, substantial, well managed. He was engaged once, 12 years ago. His intended died before they could marry. Fever. He did not manage it as society expected. That is, he did not recover on a publicly visible schedule, he did not return to the season with appropriate promptness, and he has since declined most invitations without explanation." She paused. "He attends what interests him. He ignores what does not. People find this alarming because they cannot tell whether he is judging them. Is he? Almost certainly, Cordelia said, but probably not as harshly as they fear. He is not a cruel man. He is a private one, which society mistakes for cruelty because the effect is often similar. He simply does not give people what they want from him. Camille looked at the street. Lady Hollingsworth has sent an invitation, Cordelia said, almost casually. A literary evening next week, at Greystone Court. I have heard that Malcolm Faulkner intends to attend. Camille said nothing. I thought, Cordelia continued, that it might be good for you to be seen. Not performing recovery. Simply being present. Being seen as a person who exists in the world outside of what happened in that chapel. You want to take me to a literary evening. I want to take you out of this house before you read every book in my library and retreat entirely into your own head, which is a place you spend too much time in already. Cordelia rose. Wear the deep blue. It does something particular for your complexion that I have always approved of. Camille's gaze drifted from the window to the middle, distance, to nowhere specific. Something Malcolm Faulkner had not yet said to her was already, without her understanding why, beginning to occupy the space that Alexander had left. Greystone Court was lit from within. Its windows glowed amber against the November dark as Cordelia's carriage turned through the gate, and from outside, even before the door opened, one could hear the low, layered sound of 30 or 40 voices in a room with good acoustics. The specific sound of a London literary evening, which differed from other social gatherings, in that the voices were slightly slower, slightly more considered, pausing occasionally for effect. Camille stepped out of the carriage in deep blue silk. Cordelia had been right about the color. It was a blue that was almost navy, rich and quiet and sure of itself, and it suited the mood she was attempting to project, which was the mood of someone who had simply decided to spend an evening among books and interesting people, and who had certainly not spent the past 2 weeks reconsidering every choice she had made in the last 7 years. The guests inside were precisely what she expected, titled Educated, Observant. She recognized half of them from the wedding guest list, which meant they recognized her, and the slight shift in the room's temperature as she entered, the fractional drop in voice, the careful not looking, was something she had prepared for. She accepted a glass of sherry she did not intend to drink and positioned herself near the bookshelves, which was where she actually wanted to be anyway. A volume of Tennyson's recent work had been placed on display beside a small card describing the evening's featured reading. She picked it up. She was halfway through the opening stanza of In Memoriam when she became aware that someone had come to stand beside the shelves. She looked up. The man standing there was not looking at her. He was looking at the shelves, specifically at the collection of volumes in the section to her left, his gaze moving with the unhurried certainty of someone who could navigate a library the way other men navigated ballrooms. He was tall, with the kind of build that suggested physical capability rather than decorative effect. His hair was dark and threaded at the temples with early grey that he had clearly not made any effort to conceal. His face was, she searched for the word, considered. Angles and planes that had been lived in for 36 years and showed it without apology. He was not handsome in the way Alexander was handsome. Alexander's good looks had always been the first thing people noticed. This man's face was the kind that people took a moment to arrive at, and then found themselves returning to. He reached past her, with a quiet, "Forgive me," that was genuine rather than performative, and drew a volume from the shelf. He glanced at the spine. He turned it over and read the back. He opened it to a page near the middle, read 3 lines, and closed it again. "You're not reading Tennyson," he said. It took Camille a moment to understand he was addressing her. He was still looking at the book in his hand. "I'm reading the opening," she said. "You're rereading it." Your eyes went back to the first line twice. He glanced at her then, not the surveying, appraising look she was accustomed to from men at social events, but something more direct and less interested in surface. You already know what it says. You came to the shelf because it was the one part of the room where you could stand without being required to perform comfort. The accurate observation produced in her a brief flash of something that was almost irritation, except that it was too honest to be irritating. "You have the advantage of me," she said. "Malcolm Faulkner." He did not offer a bow exactly, more an inclination of the head, precise rather than elaborate. "Duke of Ashbourne, you are Camille Kensington. I am aware of what happened 3 weeks ago." "Everyone is," she said. "Yes." He returned the book to the shelf. "I am not here to offer condolences, if that reassures you. I find condolences generally serve the person offering them more than the person receiving them." She looked at him steadily. "Then what are you here to offer?" "Nothing, at present." He turned to look at the room. "A conversation, if you wish one. Silence, if you prefer that. I find literary evenings improve with the company of someone who is actually thinking rather than performing the act of thinking." Camille followed his gaze to the assembled guests, who were moving in the comfortable, self-congratulatory orbit of people who had decided they were cultured and required periodic evidence of this. "You are very direct," she said. "I am told so frequently. People mean it as a criticism. I have chosen to receive it as a description." He glanced at her again, briefly. "Your Tennyson. Which section?" she told him. He was quiet for a moment, and then he said, "From memory. Three stanzas of In Memoriam. Not the well-known ones, not the passages that everyone quoted, but the middle stanzas, the ones buried in the sequence's long middle distance, where the grief was not dramatic but simply present, the way grief actually was, the way it sat in the chest in ordinary hours when no one was watching." She did not say anything for a moment. "A promise that costs a woman her entire future," he said, "is not devotion. It is a cage, a beautifully constructed one, but still." The sherry glass was warm in her hand. The party moved around them. She thought about 7 years and sapphire bracelets and letters from Vienna, and the particular sound of a chapel falling silent. "Do you believe," she said, "that 7 years can be mourned in 7 days?" He considered the question with a seriousness she had not expected. "No," he said, "but I believe that mourning and living are not mutually exclusive activities. The error is in waiting for the mourning to finish before resuming life. It does not finish. You carry it and go." His gaze did not slide away from her face the way most people's did when a conversation became too direct. It remained, steady, measured, present. She felt, for the first time in 3 weeks, that she was in a room with someone who was actually looking at her. Not at what she represented. Not at the scandal she had recently become. Not at the careful composure she maintained as a matter of survival. At her. Later, when the host called the room to attention for the formal reading, Malcolm found a chair near the window. Before he sat, he bent and retrieved a small volume she had not noticed she had set on the edge of the side table when someone had approached her, a volume of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's sonnets, one she had been carrying in her evening bag and had placed there by habit. He held it out to her. His gloved hand was steady. His gaze, when it met hers as she took the book, lingered for 1 second longer than courtesy required. Camille felt it in her wrist, in the place where the sapphire bracelet no longer was. She sat down on the other side of the room. She did not hear a single word of the formal reading. November gave way to December. The city drew its curtains earlier each day and burned more candles to compensate. In the parks, the last leaves came down, and the ground hardened with frost. And the season shifted into the one Camille had always found most honest, the season that made no promises of warmth, and therefore could not be accused of dishonesty. She moved through it differently than she had expected. She had anticipated, in those first raw days at Belgrave House, that recovery would feel like a slow, deliberate project, a thing she would have to manage the way she managed everything, with discipline and schedule and the careful application of effort over time. She had anticipated that she would have to decide to improve. Instead, she found herself, in small and specific ways, simply changing. The grief was still there. It was not reduced. But around it, carefully, and almost without her noticing, other things were growing back. She read voraciously. Cordelia's library had depths she had not suspected. Philosophy, natural science, political theory, poetry from 3 centuries. And Camille moved through it with the absorbed attention of someone who had been given, for the first time in years, permission to simply think about what she found interesting rather than what was required. She walked. Mayfair in early winter had its own particular beauty. The gas lights coming on at 4 o'clock, the sound of horses on cobblestones, the blue dusk settling between the tall houses. And she walked it with her pelisse pulled close and her breath making brief clouds in the cold air and her mind running freely over whatever it chose. And she saw Malcolm Faulkner, not only at the literary evening, at 3 other gatherings, a musicale at Lady Pembridge's house, a private exhibition of Turner's work at a gallery on Piccadilly, a small dinner at a mutual acquaintance's home where the table was intimate enough that conversation moved freely. At each of these occasions, their paths crossed with the natural, unforced frequency of 2 people moving in the same social orbit, and each time something accumulated between them. He did not flatter her. This was, she came to understand, a form of respect that was rarer than it appeared. Every other man of her acquaintance, in the aftermath of the wedding catastrophe, had offered her some version of flattery that was actually pity in formal dress. What a remarkable woman you are. What dignity you demonstrated. Any man would be fortunate. The performance of admiration, designed to make the speaker feel generous and the recipient feel managed. Malcolm said none of these things. Instead, at the gallery, he stood beside her before a Turner seascape and told her, with complete candor, that he had been to the Dover coast 2 times in his life, and that the painting was accurate in ways that descriptions of Turner never quite captured, that the light did do that, that the water did have exactly that quality of moving in all directions simultaneously, and that he had found the actual experience more useful for understanding the painting than any critical essay he had read. She told him she had never been to the Dover coast. He said she should go. Not perhaps one day, not you must visit. You would adore it. Simply, she should go, as a statement of fact about what would be useful for her. At the dinner, seated across from each other at a table of 12, he asked her what she had been reading, and when she named the political theory text she had been working through, Mill's recent work on liberty, he asked her what she made of the 3rd chapter specifically, and they debated it with the kind of focused attention that drew glances from the other 10 people at the table who had not expected an evening of comparative political philosophy over the fish course. Camille noticed, somewhere between the entree and the dessert, that she had not thought about Alexander in 3 hours. This had not previously happened since October. The invitation to the winter ball arrived at Belgrave House on the 15th of December. The winter ball was held annually at Winthorpe Abbey, the seat of Lord Pemberton, who had been giving this particular ball for 40 years, with the consistency of someone who had found a thing that worked and saw no reason to vary it. The guest list was fixed and illustrious. The food was excellent. The dancing began at 9 and continued until the small hours. It was, in short, one of the most visible social events of the London winter. Camille had intended not to attend. Cordelia had other plans. "This is not negotiation," Cordelia said, setting the invitation on the breakfast table between them. "You will attend. You will do so as a woman who has had 2 months to become entirely herself, which is more time than most women receive and more than you needed, because you were already almost entirely yourself before any of this happened. I have no interest in being watched, Camille said. You are already being watched. The question is merely whether you are present for it. Cordelia poured coffee. Hiding confirms the narrative that you were broken by this. Appearing well, revises the narrative entirely. And frankly, the revision is the true one. Camille looked at the invitation. What would you have me wear? She asked. Cordelia's expression was the precise expression of a general who has been waiting for the moment to deploy their best regiment. The burgundy velvet, she said immediately. Winthorpe Abbey, on the night of the winter ball, was everything it always was, and, on this particular night, more. The great hall had been draped in evergreen boughs, and hung with hundreds of candles in arrangements that mimicked chandeliers. The orchestra was already playing when Camille arrived, a Strauss waltz moving through the warm air with the particular quality of music in a room that is still filling, slightly anticipatory, slightly too large for the current number of dancers, waiting for the moment when the space would be properly inhabited. She stood at the top of the stair for the moment it took to arrange herself. The burgundy velvet was deep and warm, and it moved. Well, when she descended the steps, each fold catching the candlelight in its own way. Her hair was dressed simply tonight, unpinned enough to allow two dark curls to rest at her throat, and she wore no jewels except a small pair of garnet earrings that had been her grandmother's. She was not trying to impress anyone. She had put on the velvet because it was armor and comfort simultaneously, because the color was not the ivory of a bride or the black of mourning, but something between the two, something that said, I have been to a difficult country, and I have returned from it, and I am not unchanged, but I am standing. She descended the stairs. She was aware of the room shifting to receive her. Not dramatically, not the way it had in the chapel, with the chapel's terrible collective intake of breath. This was softer, a gradual reorientation. Heads turning in the peripheral way of people who are attempting not to appear to look. She crossed the floor toward Cordelia. She passed Alexander. She had known he would be here. He and Mabel had been at several events this season, appearing together with the careful, slightly over-coordinated manner of a couple still negotiating the public performance of happiness. She saw him in her peripheral vision. She did not stop. She did not look. But she heard the small, involuntary sound he made as she passed. Not a word. Not quite a breath. More like a thought that had escaped before he could prevent it. She found Cordelia near the fireplace. Good entrance, Cordelia said, which from her was high praise. Camille accepted a glass of champagne and turned her back to the room to look into the fire for a moment, because she was human. And the fire was warm, and she needed 3 seconds to simply be. Miss Kensington. She turned. Malcolm Faulkner was beside her. He had been there, she realized, for a moment already. Not approaching dramatically, not arranging himself for effect. Simply present, the way he tended to be. He was dressed simply in dark wool, and the candlelight did something to the planes of his face, that the daylight of gallery exhibitions and dinner tables had not, catching the grey at his temples and making his expression look, for a moment, almost gentle. Duke of Ashbourne, she said. You look well, he said. It was the first time he had said anything of the kind to her, and because he was Malcolm, and therefore not given to empty compliments, the words carried a weight they would not have carried from anyone else. He meant it as information. She absorbed it as such. I feel it, she said, which was also, somewhat surprisingly, true. Across the room, she was aware of Mabel watching them, and of Alexander watching Mabel watch them. The geometry of it was almost interesting, if one had the distance to find it so. When the orchestra shifted to a waltz 20 minutes later, Alexander crossed the room. Camille saw him coming. She had time to arrange herself, to decide, in the 3 seconds his approach allowed, exactly what expression she would offer, and exactly what she would say. He reached her. "Camille." His voice was lower than she remembered. The 6 months of formal courtship had been conducted at a volume appropriate for drawing rooms and families. This was a different register. "May I have this dance?" She was aware of the room. She was also aware of Malcolm, standing 2 feet to her left. Malcolm said quietly, without particular emphasis, "I believe Miss Kensington promised this one to me." He had not. They both knew he had not. But the lie was offered with such composure and such complete conviction that the room had no mechanism for doubting it. Camille turned to Malcolm. "I believe you are right," she said, with equal conviction. "Forgive me, Your Grace." This last to Alexander, with a precision that was not quite an apology. She took Malcolm's arm. The waltz that followed was not a comfortable dance, and not a safe one. It was the kind of dance that happens when two people who have been circling a truth for months suddenly find themselves in a physical proximity from which the truth cannot be maintained at a respectful distance. His hand at her waist was correct, exactly where propriety required it. And yet, the warmth of it moved through the fabric of her gown in a way that she was acutely, specifically aware of. She had been touched. Gloved hands, polite gestures, the formal contacts of 7 years of social engagement. But she had not been held, even in this restrained, fully public, entirely appropriate way, with any sense that the person holding her was present in the holding. Malcolm was present. He led without force. The guidance of the dance, offered through pressure so subtle she might have doubted it, if not for the way her body simply followed, the way one follows something one trusts rather than something one obeys. "You could have told me," he said, close enough that only she could hear, "that he was coming." "I could have," she agreed. "You handled it well." "I have had practice," she said, "at handling things in rooms where I am being watched." Something shifted in his expression. Not quite pain, but its relative. Recognition. "You should not have needed that practice." She had no answer for that. That was not more honesty than a waltz could contain. So she said nothing, and they turned together in the candlelight, and the music moved through them both. Mabel's voice reached her between measures, high and bright and just slightly too sharp, directed at something Cordelia had said. And Camille felt Malcolm's hand at her waist apply the faintest increase of pressure, not pulling her closer, simply present. "Steady." "I see it," the pressure said. "I see what it costs you. I am here." When the music ended, and he returned her to Cordelia's side, he took her gloved hand, both of them still, the room still watching, and inclined his head and pressed his lips to her knuckles with a deliberate slowness that had nothing performative about it. His eyes met hers over the back of her hand, and held. She felt it everywhere. She felt it in her throat and in her wrists, and in the place behind her ribs where the grief had lived for 8 weeks, and was, she realized, in this moment, no longer entirely alone in occupying the space. He let her hand go. He stepped back. He did not smile, but something in his expression shifted. Not satisfaction. Not triumph. More like the expression of a man who has been carrying a weight alone for a very long time, and has felt, for the first time, someone else's hand, briefly, alongside his, beneath it. Across the room, Mabel gripped Alexander's arm and said something too quietly to hear. Alexander did not answer. He was watching Camille. The snow came that night. It arrived after midnight, silent and thorough, laying itself across the grounds of Winthorpe Abbey with the unhurried confidence of something that knows it will not be argued with. By 2 o'clock in the morning, the gravel of the outer drive had disappeared beneath it. By 3, the road back to London had become, in the considered opinion of Lord Pemberton's head groom, impassable until daylight. 37 guests remained at Winthorpe Abbey. Rooms were prepared. The household was roused from sleep. Cold chicken and bread and wine were arranged in the drawing room for those who were not yet ready to give up the evening. The orchestra had long since packed their instruments, but someone had found a pianoforte in the south parlour, and someone else had volunteered to play, and a smaller, quieter version of the ball continued in that warm interior space while the snow thickened outside. Camille could not sleep. She had been given a room on the second floor, small, properly appointed, faintly lavender-scented, and she had sat on the edge of the bed for 20 minutes, listening to the muffled sound of the piano below and the deeper silence of the snow outside before accepting that sleep was not coming. She found, downstairs, a door to the glass conservatory. The conservatory was attached to the east side of the house, a long structure of iron and glass that extended into the garden like an afterthought. Built in the 1830s, she judged from its style, by someone who had been very interested in botanical specimens, and less interested in whether the structure was adequately heated. The plants in it were numerous and green and somewhat wild, citrus trees and exotic ferns, growing in the dim warmth that a single bank of small stoves produced along the northern wall. She stood in the middle of it and looked out through the glass walls at the snow. It fell without sound, or with a sound below hearing, drifting in slow diagonals through the dark. The garden beyond had been rendered abstract, lawn, hedge, statue, simplified into shapes by the accumulating white. One of the candelabras from the party had been left burning on a table just inside. The door, its light making the glass walls glow softly, turning the interior into a kind of lantern. She had been there perhaps a quarter of an hour when she heard the door behind her. She turned. Malcolm closed the door behind him with care. He took in the room, the plants, the glass, the snow, with a glance that was unhurried. He was still dressed, his coat slightly undone, his cravat loosened by what she suspected was a single strategic release. He looked, in the conservatory light, less defended than she had ever seen him in a formal setting. The grey at his temples was more visible, the lines of his face more readable. He said nothing. He simply moved to the opposite wall of glass and looked out at the snow. After a moment, she said, "You cannot sleep either." "I rarely sleep well in unfamiliar houses," he said. "There is a particular quality to the silence in a house one doesn't know. It presses differently than the silence of one's own rooms." She understood this precisely. She had not slept well in a familiar house for 2 months. The snow fell. The conservatory was warm enough to be comfortable, cold enough to be aware of. Somewhere, a citrus tree was putting out small white flowers, and the faint scent of them moved through the air between the larger smells of earth and green growing things. "May I ask you something?" she said. "Yes." "Your intended. The woman you were engaged to. Was it?" She paused. She was not accustomed to asking the questions that required this kind of care. "Was the grief sudden, or did it arrive slowly?" He was quiet for a long moment. She thought, briefly, that she had overstepped. "Both," he said. "The first part was sudden. She was ill for 3 days, and then she was gone. And the sudden part was those 3 days, and then the end of those 3 days." He paused. "The slow part was the years afterward, finding her in unexpected places, a particular shade of yellow in a painting, a specific phrase in a letter from someone else. The grief did not diminish. It became more specific, smaller and more precise, and therefore, in some ways, harder to deflect." Camille turned from the glass to look at him. He had not moved from his position against the opposite wall, but she felt, in the narrow width of the conservatory, that the space between them was different than it had been a moment ago. "I am told," she said, "that I should be grateful, that Alexander has done me a service by revealing his nature before the marriage rather than within it. People tell you that because they do not know what else to say, Malcolm said. Not because it is useful. No, she said. It is not useful. She pressed her fingers against the cold glass. What is strange, what I cannot quite resolve, is that I am not certain it is even Alexander I am grieving. I think I am grieving the 7 years. The person I was for 7 years. She believed in something that turned out not to exist, and she gave everything for it. And I am not entirely certain how to... She stopped. How to hold her, he said. She looked at him. The woman you were then, he said. She was not foolish. She was faithful. They are different things. What happened to her does not make her choices wrong. It makes them costly. His voice was very quiet. There is no shame in what she paid. The shame belongs entirely to the people who let her pay it. Camille was aware, somewhere behind her ribs, of something releasing, not dramatically, not with any visible evidence, but release nonetheless, the specific, quiet release of a grip that has been held so long it has become invisible, and one does not realize it was held until it is not. She looked at the snow. He looked at the snow. The conservatory door, she noticed it now, for the first time, had frost around its frame. The temperature had dropped enough in the hour since midnight that the latch had contracted. She tried it briefly and found it firm. We may be here for some time, she said, without particular alarm. I expect so, he agreed. He moved to the stoves and checked them. Efficient, unhurried, and added coal from the scuttle beside them. He set his coat over a nearby chair. She sat on the iron bench along the southern wall. He sat on the opposite end of it. The space between them was correct, appropriate, and somehow more charged than any incorrect distance she had experienced in 7 years of formal courtship. She said, Tell me about Ashbourne, your estate. Tell me something specific about it. He looked at her. The question had surprised him, not unpleasantly. There is a library, he said. The second floor, east wing. The windows face the moors, and in November, when the moors go grey, the room fills with a particular kind of light that... He paused. It is the kind of light that makes you feel the room has been waiting for you, which is, I am aware, a slightly irrational description. It's a perfect description, she said. There is also a greenhouse attached to the north wall of the house. Not as elaborate as this. He glanced at the conservatory around them. But better heated. I grow things in it. Tomatoes, which are entirely impractical for the climate, and a fig tree that has no business surviving a Derbyshire winter, and yet has done so for 8 years. Which I find personally encouraging. Camille looked at him. The fig tree that had no business surviving the winter, and had done so for 8 years. She did not say anything. She did not need to. She understood that he had just told her, in the language of stubborn, impractical, growing things, something about himself and about survival, and about the willingness to continue. She said, I used to read in the evenings. Before. During the 7 years, I mean. I read a great deal because I was waiting, and there was not much else to do that felt honest. I read things I was not supposed to read. Political theory, law, science. Not for any purpose. Simply because they were interesting, and my mind needed something to do. And when did you stop? When Alexander returned. She considered. I think I believed that being properly occupied with the preparations, being the right kind of woman for the occasion, required me to be somewhat less occupied with my own mind. She paused. I am reading again now. Good, he said. Simply that. Good. Not how wonderful, how brave, what a remarkable woman. Just good. As though it were exactly what ought to be happening and required no special praise. Something in Camille's chest turned, slowly, like a key in a lock it had not expected to fit. Outside, the snow continued without mercy and without apology. Inside, The faint scent of citrus blossoms moved between them, and the conservatory glowed. She was not aware of the exact moment when she leaned her shoulder against the iron post of the bench, or of the exact moment when that small movement placed her closer to him than she had been. She was aware only that at some point during the conversation, during the description of the Ashbourne Library and its November light, or the fig tree that should not have survived and had, something in the careful architecture of her composure made a decision to become slightly less architectural. She said quietly, looking at the snow, "You have not looked at me the way people usually look at me. Not since the literary evening. How do people usually look at you?" "As a symbol of something," she said. "Before, as the promised bride, as Alexander's arrangement, as the Kensington alliance, now, as the wronged woman, as a cautionary tale or a triumphant one, depending on the observer's preference." She paused. "You look at me as though I am simply present." He turned to look at her then, fully, in the conservatory light. "You are not a symbol," he said. "You are a person, specifically." And he paused here, in a way that suggested he was choosing words with the care he gave most things. "You are a person of particular quality, unusual quality, the kind that is not visible in introductions or first impressions, but becomes apparent through conversation and observation over time, the kind that is, in my experience, rare." The silence afterward was the kind that is not empty, but full. She felt the pull of him, not the pull of desperation, not the pull of loneliness, but the pull of something genuine, of two specific people in a specific room who had found, through conversation, that they occupied more of the same interior country than either had expected. She felt it in the way one feels certain truths, as recognition rather than discovery. As of course, as here. She said, just above a whisper, "You do not always have to be quite so honorable." He looked at her. His expression was something she had not seen there before. Still controlled, still deliberate, but with something behind it that was neither controlled nor deliberate. Something that had been present and restrained for weeks, and was, at this proximity, in this warmth, difficult to continue restraining. He lifted his hand, his fingers bare, his gloves long since removed, rested at the line of her jaw, barely. The way one rests a hand near a flame to feel the warmth without burning. She did not pull back. He leaned forward. The kiss, when it came, was not what 7 years of imagined romance had suggested kisses were. It was not urgent or consuming. It was careful, almost unbearably careful. The care of someone who understands the weight of what he is doing and refuses to treat it as light. His lips were warm and still, and hers answered in kind, and the space between restraint and tenderness was navigated with a precision that left her breathless, not from force, but from the fullness of being met exactly where she stood. When he drew back, barely an inch, she felt his breath against her lips. Her hand had found, at some point, the lapel of his coat. She was aware of the weight of it in her fingers. He looked at her with an expression she now recognized as the inverse of what he showed the world. Not closed, but open. Not guarded, but given. "Camille," he said. Just that. Her name. As though saying it was the thing. The frost in the conservatory door released at 5:30 in the morning. Light was beginning to blue the glass walls. They walked back into the house separately, a proper interval between them, both maintaining the composure that the occasion required. But when he held the door for her and she passed through it, his hand touched the small of her back, briefly, barely, and she felt it still, an hour later, lying in the small, lavender-scented room with the sound of the house beginning its morning movements below. She lay in the grey light and thought about fig trees that should not have survived the winter. She thought about someone who looked at her not as a symbol, but as a person. She thought about November light in a library over Derbyshire moors. She thought about none of it being promised, and for the first time in 7 years, the absence of a promise felt not like loss, but like space, like room to choose freely, like something that could, if approached with courage, become exactly what she had always wanted. January arrived with the particular coldness of a city that has stopped pretending. Society moved through its early weeks in the compressed, indoor way of people who have decided winter is a social event rather than a weather phenomenon. The season's main attractions were not yet underway. Those would come in spring, with the balls and presentations and morning calls. But the private dinners and literary gatherings and musicales continued, and through these smaller venues, London talked. What it talked about, in January of 1853, was the state of the Ravenshire marriage. The whispers had begun at Christmas and grown through the new year with the quiet efficiency of whispers that have substantial material to work with. Alexander and Mabel had appeared at the Pemberton Christmas gathering, looking, as one sharp-eyed lady of the older generation put it, very carefully happy, which was the expression of people performing contentment rather than experiencing it. Mabel had been seen crying at a private party. Alexander had been observed at his club on 3 consecutive evenings when he should, by all social expectation, have been at home. Cordelia, who possessed informational networks that outpaced any newspaper, relayed these details to Camille over breakfast with the calm interest of a naturalist reporting observations from the field. "It is not satisfying," Camille said, looking at her tea. "What isn't?" "Knowing they are unhappy. I thought it would be. I thought there would be some resolution in it. Some sense of order restored." Cordelia considered. "There is no satisfaction in someone else's suffering. What you are feeling is not the absence of satisfaction. It is the presence of something more complicated. The recognition that their unhappiness doesn't, in fact, undo yours." "No," Camille agreed. "It doesn't." She thought about the conservatory. She had thought about the conservatory with precise and specific frequency every day since December. She and Malcolm had seen each other twice since then, once at a dinner, once at a gallery, and both occasions had been conducted with the careful, somewhat heightened, propriety of people who are aware of what they know and what has changed, and who are allowing the change to settle before naming it. There had been no further conversations alone. There had been no repetition of the conservatory's intimacy. But his hand had touched hers once, reaching for the same book on a gallery table, and the contact had lasted 1 second beyond accidental, and they had both been still for that second, and then moved apart, and the whole of it, the stillness, the deliberateness of it, the careful release, had been more explicit in its meaning than anything a less restrained person could have manufactured. She was in the Belgrave Library on the afternoon of the 12th of January when the butler announced Alexander. She sat very still for a moment. Then she said, "Show him to the drawing room. I will be down in 5 minutes." She used those 5 minutes to put down her book, straighten her dress, and arrange herself into the particular composure that was not armor exactly, but was not unrelated to it. The composure of someone who knows what she is walking into, and has decided in advance how she intends to arrive. Alexander Stirling, 7th Duke of Ravenshire, was standing at the drawing-room window when she entered. He turned when she came in, and she saw immediately that the 8 months since their last conversation had not improved his ease. He was as handsome as ever. That bone structure did not diminish with regret. But there was something about him that suggested a man who had recently discovered that the life he had chosen bore no resemblance to the one he had imagined, and who had not yet decided what to do with that discovery. He looked at her with the expression she had been expecting, the expression of a man who is about to say something honest, and is aware that honesty, at this point, arrives several months too late. "Camille," he said. Alexander, she said. She did not sit. She stood near the door, her hands folded, her posture precisely what it had always been in his presence. I assume you are not here on social business? No. He turned from the window. I needed to see you. You have seen me, she said, at several gatherings this season. We have managed perfectly adequate knots. That is not what I mean. He moved closer, not inappropriately so, simply enough to make the conversation less rhetorical. I mean, speak to you. Properly. She waited. I think about the 7 years, he said. Often, do you? I think of them, she said. I think of them as years I survived. Something moved in his expression. Survived is a harder word than I expected. Is it? 7 years of waiting is difficult. I expected it to be worth something. When it turned out not to be, surviving seems like an accurate description of what got me through. She held his gaze without softness. What did you want to tell me? He ran a hand through his hair, a gesture she recognized, the gesture of a man collecting himself. I think I made a mistake. The room was quiet. Camille said nothing. Not, he added quickly, in the sense that I'm asking you to. I am not here to. Mabel is my wife. I am not here to pretend that is not real, or that I do not carry responsibility for it. He paused. But I think I acted rashly. I think. He stopped again. You were the foundation, he said, finally, more quietly. That is not something I understood while you were present. I understood it when you left. Your steadiness. Your. The way you thought. The way you held things. I thought these were simply how things were. I did not understand they were you. She looked at him. You were describing a house, she said. Not a person. You are telling me that you miss the stability I provided, the sense of order, the function I served in the life you were constructing. She kept her voice measured, entirely without rancor. You are not describing missing me, Alexander. You are describing missing what I did. Those are different things. He had no answer for this. I was not born, she said, to steady, careless men. He looked at her for a long moment. Something in his face shifted. Not quite grief, but its neighbor. The expression of someone who has received the honest answer to a question they already knew the answer to. Malcolm Faulkner, he said. Has he? Malcolm found me, she said. After you abandoned me. The word abandoned sat in the room between them. She had not chosen it carelessly. Alexander nodded once, the nod of a man accepting a verdict. I see. I hope, she said, with a sincerity that was not unkind, that you find a way to make something real of what you chose, not for my sake, for your own. He left 5 minutes later. She heard the outer door close. She heard his carriage on the street below. She stood at the window and watched it go. She felt, not triumph, not satisfaction. What she felt was something quieter and more definitive than either of those. The sensation of a door she had not realized was still open, finally, gently, closing. February came in with cold, clear days that had a particular quality of light. Winter light, sharp and angular, throwing long shadows even at noon, making everything it touched precise and clearly delineated in a way that the softer months did not. Camille walked more than she had in years. She walked Mayfair and Belgravia and the park in Hyde, where the frozen serpentine reflected the sky in fractured planes of ice. She walked the long way around, and the short way, and the way that went past the bookshop on Piccadilly, where she had, increasingly, begun to spend money she did not technically need to spend on volumes she did not technically have room for, but was finding it impossible not to acquire. She was happy, not in the exuberant, uncomplicated way of someone who has been spared difficulty, in the specific, earned way of someone who has been through the difficulty and has emerged from it with a clearer understanding of what happiness, for her specifically, consists of. Conversation and books and winter light and walking and the company of people who required nothing from her except what she actually was. She had received two letters from Malcolm in the past month. They were not love letters. They were something better in their way. They were the letters of a man who found her interesting and wanted to think alongside her. The first had contained, at some length, his thoughts on a volume of political theory they had discussed at a dinner and had concluded with a question that required her genuine engagement to answer. The second had described the Ashbourne greenhouse in February, the fig tree, still improbably surviving, putting out one small new leaf, and had asked whether she had given any further thought to Dover. She had written back to both. Her replies were longer than his. She had a great deal to say when someone asked her real questions. She was at the Belgrave Library on the afternoon of the 23rd of February, when Cordelia came to the doorway with the specific expression she reserved for information of particular significance. "Malcolm Faulkner is calling this afternoon," Cordelia said. "He has asked to speak with you. He was quite specific on that point. With you, not with me." Camille set down her book. "He is coming here," she said. "He is coming here," Cordelia confirmed. She paused at the door. "I will be in my sitting room, entirely occupied with my correspondence." Her expression communicated that she would, in fact, be listening acutely for the duration of whatever followed. Camille smoothed her dress. It was the deep blue again. She had been wearing it often lately, had begun to think of it as the color of her actual life, the one she was building, rather than any life she had inherited. Malcolm arrived at 3:30. He was shown to the drawing room. She was already there, seated, but not with the deliberate, receiving quality of someone performing composure. Simply there, the book from the library in her lap, a fire burning cleanly in the grate. He came in and she rose, and for a moment they simply looked at each other in the winter afternoon light. He said, "I am going to be direct." "I would be surprised if you were otherwise," she said. He moved further into the room. He did not sit. He stood in the middle of the drawing room, not rigidly, not performing, simply with the particular quality of presence he always carried, and looked at her with the clear, direct attention she had come to understand as one of his most fundamental characteristics. "I have spent 12 years," he said, "believing that the future I was walking toward was the only one that would have suited me. The future I had before Catherine died, I held that belief with complete conviction and used it as a sufficient reason to avoid building any other." He paused. "Then I met you, and the conviction became increasingly difficult to maintain." She held his gaze. "I am not asking you to resolve anything about the past," he said, "yours or mine. I am not asking you to be the woman you would have been before October. I have no interest in her. With respect, she was not the woman I know." He moved closer, and his voice dropped not in volume, but in register, in the way that very honest things sometimes do when they are finally given air. "I want the woman who walked alone down that chapel aisle and held her spine straight and didn't give the room what it wanted from her. I want the woman who found the letters and sat with the truth of them instead of turning away. I want the woman who has read her way through an entire library since December and can argue Mill's third chapter at a dinner table and does not require anyone's permission to be exactly what she is." Camille was very still. "I do not want the woman you were promised to become," he said. "I want the woman you fought to become." The fire moved in the grate. The winter light fell across the drawing room in its precise February way. Somewhere in the house, Cordelia was being extremely quiet. "You are proposing," she said. "I am," he said. without a ballroom, without a performance, without anything except the belief, which I hold with more certainty than I have held most things, that we understand each other with unusual thoroughness, and that this understanding is the most reliable foundation I have encountered for a life shared. Camille set the book on the table beside her. She thought, briefly, a quick-moving thought, about the old oak tree at Thornwick Hall, about 17 and a promise held with such faith, about ivory silk and sapphire bracelets, and 7 years of letters from a man who had been, she understood now, describing his own loneliness rather than reaching for her, about an October morning, and a chapel, and the particular sound of 500 people losing their language. She thought about a glass conservatory in the snow, about fig trees in February putting out new leaves, about November light over Derbyshire moors, about her name in his voice, just that, just Camille, as though saying it was enough. She thought about what it meant to be chosen, not promised, not arranged, not traded between families as the resolution of a financial alignment, chosen, freely, with full knowledge of who she was and without requiring her to be anything she was not. Chosen by someone who had looked at her, specifically and carefully, across months of conversation and restraint and honest feeling, and arrived at the choice because of everything he had seen, rather than despite it. "Yes," she said. He crossed to her. He took her hand, bare, her gloves left upstairs, her fingers cold from the February air that came through the window frame, and held it between both of his with the same care he brought to every gesture. He was not a man who moved through moments quickly. He held the weight of things. "I am not an easy man," he said, with the frankness that was among the first things she had noticed about him. "I am not an easy woman," she said. Something moved in his expression that was, unmistakably, close to a smile. "No," he said, "you are not. It is one of the things I most admire." They were married on the 14th of March, 1853. The ceremony was held in the chapel at Ashbourne, smaller than St. Bartholomew, older, built of local stone that had turned the pale gold of long service. The pews held 40 people, not 500. Cordelia sat in the front row and wore her finest emerald green and did not cry, which was the highest form of emotional response she permitted herself. The guests were those who had been chosen for their genuine connection rather than their social function, and the difference was perceptible in the quality of the room. Camille wore pale gold silk, not ivory. She had decided, with the quiet determination that had become one of her most reliable faculties, that ivory belonged to a different chapter. Gold was the color of what came after surviving, warm, unashamed, lit from within. Her hair was dressed simply, with a single white flower from Malcolm's greenhouse. The fig tree had not produced flowers, being a fig tree, but the lemon tree had obliged with enthusiasm, and she wore no jewels except a pair of pearl earrings that had been her grandmother's. She walked down the aisle without being given. She had told her father, in a brief and definitive letter, that she would be walking in of her own choice, and that choice was in itself the point. Malcolm was standing at the altar. He was watching her walk toward him with the expression she had come, over the past months, to recognize as his most honest one. Not the public composure, not the social distance, but the open expression he reserved for the moments that he allowed to matter. He watched her come to him with something in his face that was patient and present and sure. She reached him. He took her hand. They exchanged vows that were simple and direct, and did not attempt to encompass everything, because they had both learned that the vow worth making was not a speech but a choice, repeated, daily, in small things and large, in the library and the greenhouse, and the rooms where it was only the two of them, and no performance was required. "I choose you." That was the vow in all its forms. Not because arrangement required it, not because family expected it, not because 7 years of waiting had built a structure that needed its final stone, because of everything he had seen in her, and everything she had seen in him, and the daily, freely made decision that both of them intended to keep. There was a garden at the back of Belgrave House, small, walled, not particularly remarkable, except for an old oak tree in its southern corner that was nothing like the oak at Thornwick Hall, but served, on the afternoon of the wedding, as a location for a brief and private conversation between two people who had much to say to each other and most of the rest of their lives to say it. Malcolm stood beneath it with her in the early spring afternoon, the sky the specific pale blue of March, the first grass showing beneath the old leaves, and held her hand while they said nothing for a long time, in the comfortable way of people who have already used their words well, and do not need more of them to know where they stand. "Ashbourne," she said, eventually. "The library with the moor light." "In November," he confirmed. "We will go before then. But November is worth staying for. And the greenhouse." "The fig tree will be interested to meet you," he said. "It has withstood considerable adversity. You will have a great deal in common." She looked at him, that almost smile again, warmer now that she knew it, easier to read. She thought of all the things that had been necessary to arrive here, the 7 years and the promise and the wedding that wasn't, and the humiliation that she had carried out of on her own spine, the letters behind the bookshelves, the literary evening, and the winter ball and the snow that had sealed a conservatory door with frost and given them hours of honest conversation, the fig tree in February, the letters that had travelled between London and Derbyshire, and had been more intimate than any stolen glance, because they had required thought and offered it. All of it had been necessary. She did not forgive Alexander, exactly. Forgiveness was a complicated thing, and did not happen on schedules that suited anyone's narrative convenience. But she understood, standing beneath the old oak tree in Cordelia's garden in the early March light, that what he had done, as devastating as it had been, had also been the beginning of her actual life. Not the life arranged for her. Not the life she had shaped herself around in anticipation of a promise. The life she was choosing, freely, with full knowledge of who she was. Alexander Stirling, Duke of Ravenshire, attended the wedding of Camille Kensington and Malcolm Faulkner, Duke of Ashbourne, in his capacity as a member of the extended social network that made his absence more conspicuous than his presence. He stood at the back of the small chapel and watched Camille walk down the aisle in pale gold silk, and understood, with the complete, irreversible understanding of someone who has received a thing too late, what he had allowed to leave his life. Not the arrangement, not the alliance. Her, the specific, rare, irreplaceable quality of her, the depth of her, the steadiness that he had mistaken for simply how things were, and had only recognized as hers when it was gone. He watched Malcolm take her hand. He watched the look that passed between them. The particular private look of two people who have worked hard to understand each other and have succeeded. He left before the ceremony was finished. He had no right to the ending, and he knew it. Mabel was in the carriage. They rode home in silence. Camille became Duchess of Ashbourne on the 14th of March, 1853, at age 24. She became a duchess not because she had waited, and not because she had been arranged, and not because she had fit correctly into a structure that required a woman of her specification. She became a duchess because a man of intelligence and patience and unusual quality had looked at her thoroughly, specifically, over months and conversations and honest moments in candlelit conservatories during snowstorms, and had decided, freely and deliberately, that she was who he wanted beside him for the rest of his life. And she had decided the same of him. In the spring, they went to Ashbourne. The library was exactly as he had described it, the windows facing the moors, the light doing precisely what November light over Derbyshire moors does, which is to enter sideways and bronze everything it touches, and make the room feel, as he had said, as though it has been waiting. She stood in it for the first time, and felt its warmth settle around her. She would spend many hours in this room, thinking, reading, writing, occasionally arguing with Malcolm about Mill, occasionally winning those arguments, occasionally losing them, finding in both outcomes the particular satisfaction of being in the company of someone who met her as an equal. He came to stand beside her at the window. They looked out at the moors together. "Well," he said. "Better than described," she said. His hand found hers. Outside, the Derbyshire sky was doing the thing that Derbyshire skies do in spring, shifting rapidly between cloud and clarity, between grey and brilliant, between the promise of rain and the delivery of light. It was not a reliable sky. It did not make promises it could guarantee to keep. It was, she thought, perfectly honest. And she had found, in the past months, that she had a particular appreciation for honesty, for the things that were real rather than arranged, for the love that asked you to be yourself rather than the version of yourself that someone else had constructed in their imagination. She held his hand. She looked at the honest sky. She was exactly where she had chosen to be. That, she thought, with the quiet, unambiguous conviction of someone who has earned the right to know the difference, was everything. And that is the story of Camille Kensington, a woman who lost everything at the altar and found something far greater in the ruins. If this story touched you, hit that like button right now and subscribe so you never miss a story on this channel. Share this video with someone who loves a good romance, because Camille's story deserves to be heard. And before you go, drop a comment below. Who was your favorite character? What moment broke you? What moment healed you? We are reading every single one. The next story is already waiting for you. See you there.